The views expressed on this program are those of the host and the participants.
Greetings. Welcome back to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, here on WILL AM 580 from Urbana, Illinois, Campbell Hall on the campus of the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. Today we're going to be talking about news and journalism and the caliber of our political democracy, and we have two distinguished guests here in the studio. Michael Delli Carpini is the Dean of the Annenberg School for Communication at the University of Pennsylvania, and has had a long and distinguished career not only in academia but in the philanthropic world as the Director of Public Policy at Pew Charitable Trust for 4 years, and as a political science faculty member at Barnard College and at Columbia University. He's the author of numerous articles and books, and the book, is that right, Michael?
A couple of books,
but the one listed here, What Americans Know About Politics and Why It Matters. Thank you for joining us, Michael.
My pleasure.
In town from Philadelphia, I might add, for this event. Well, not just for the show, but for some other stuff, too. And with us also in the studio, Bruce Williams, my colleague, the director of the Institute of Communications Research at the U of I here, and author of numerous books and articles. We'll cut to the chase here. The two of you who are co-authoring a brand new book that you've been working on for a couple of years. Title now is And the Walls Came Tumbling Down, The Eroding Boundaries Between News and Entertainment, and What They Mean for the Mediated Politics in the 21st Century. Wow, that's a hell of a name, guys.
Yeah, we got to shorten that.
Now, that was actually, this is a secret for you assistant professors and grad students out there listening. This was actually something, I don't know why you two as full professors would do this, but this title, I think, would take four lines in a CV. That gets you to another page almost.
Exactly.
It's really quite brilliant. But we'll just call it And the Walls Came Tumbling Down. This book, you've almost done with it. Is that right?
Yes.
Yeah, we're pretty much completed with a draft of the manuscript. Looks like it's going to come out with possibility of a couple of different presses right at the moment, but we're hoping that within the next year it'll be available to the public.
Now, we had you both on the show together, Bruce and Michael, I think it was in the summer of 2002, and we talked about the book then, which you were in the process of writing, and so much has happened. I mean, it's like you're writing a book about contemporary trends in journalism, and it's sort of like trying to write a book on military strategy in the middle of a battle with bombs going off all around you, isn't it?
Well, there's definitely an aspect of that to it. I mean, a lot of the basic trends that we've noticed from starting this project still are in existence, but they've accelerated. So one of the premises of the book is that in recent times, for a variety of reasons, there's been a growing importance to what we traditionally think of as entertainment media. And at the time we were doing this, we could see pieces of that, but it's almost impossible to avoid it now. And so it's become much more dramatic in the ways in which the line between what we think of as journalism and what we think of as non-public affairs media have eroded almost completely now.
And Bruce, that is the thesis of the book, basically, what Michael just said?
And it's something that we try and make clear is we're not claiming that this that entertainment media is terribly important to the political process. We're not claiming that's something that's new. If you go back to the 1960s or 70s, you find movies, books, all sorts of things. Think of, you know, MASH, Catch-22, things like that. All the Vietnam War movies, which had clearly a political impact. What we think makes this trend more work differently today is that the media environment, the way in which people get their political information, is so different today that basically the kind of the center has come unstuck. The center used to be professional journalism. It was kind of there that you went for your basic understanding of what was important in the world and what was going on, and they were supposed to provide it in a way that was, in a term that has different meaning today, they were supposed to be fair and balanced.
Mm-hmm.
And so they, in political science terms, they set the agenda. They told a large part of the public what it was important to think about. And then clearly you could find things that were related to that in the broader environment. But we think that that with the decline of the audience for network news, with the decline of readership, with the fragmentation of things like cable news networks and the internet, that people are just picking and choose, are able to pick and choose a lot more what sources of information they're getting. And so the role of non-news sources of information is different today than it used to be.
Now, is this primarily a generational phenomenon? I mean, we're all professors, and I go into my classes today, and if I ask a large undergraduate class, how many of you read a daily newspaper every day? Very few hands go up. When I was in college in the early 70s, now granted, it was usually the sports section, but my hand would have gone up really quickly. I mean, most of my friends would have been roughly familiar with what was in the headline of the local newspaper. I mean, is it generational? Is it primarily, or is there something beyond that?
I think it's way beyond generational. I think that if you look at the way we and I mean certainly the American public takes in media, it's just very different than it was in the 1970s. Just think about it. Now you can watch. You have 24-hour news channels. So I can't remember the last time that I really watched the nightly network news broadcast. And whereas when I was a student, if I didn't do that, I was accused of being, and maybe quite rightly, ill-informed and not knowing what was going on. But today, that's clearly not the
case. No, I obviously have that experience as well. We're talking today on Media Matters with Michael Della Carpini and Bruce Williams, who you just heard. Bruce Williams is the director of the Institute of Communications Research right here on the U of I campus. And Michael Della Carpini is the dean of the Annenberg School for Communications at the University of Pennsylvania. He's in town for a session with his co-author, Bruce Williams. They've written a book, And the Walls Came Tumbling Down. It will be out in the next year or two. They've been working on it. We're talking about that book and about news coverage and trends in journalism today on Media Matters. Let me remind you that this show is pre-recorded a couple weeks before going on air, so it'll be timely. But please don't try to call in today. Just sit back and let three professional talkers do the talking for the hour. Michael, where are people getting their news then, if not the evening news? Now, Bruce mentioned cable, 24-hour cable channels. But my sense is you've got a much broader argument than just the rise of cable channels.
Well, that's absolutely true. And just to follow up on your last question, I think that there is a generational component to part of this. If you look at recent surveys like one that was done by the Pew Research Center, upwards of 60% of 18 to 25-year-olds now say that they get a significant portion of their political information from shows like The Daily Show. The general population still admits that 25% of them will say that they also get a significant proportion of their news that way. So there is a generational aspect. And
wait, are The Daily Show's ratings that high? We always hear about The Daily Show. My God, what sort of ratings are these guys getting?
You can only trust self-reports on these kind of things somewhat. And remember that people will dip in and out of these shows, so the Nielsen ratings aren't necessarily the gold standard for how we know this. But The Daily Show has gotten upwards of 2 million people watching it at various points. It outranked in some of the convention coverage any of the cable networks. So you really do have a fragmented audience, but the implications of a show like The Daily Show, in fact, reverberate beyond who watches it, because you can now watch CNN or Fox News and have snippets of The Daily Show shown on there. And so I think one of the things that we're seeing right now is a fragmentation of the sources, not just between entertainment and non-entertainment, but even amongst the so-called news stations. So to go back to your question, people are getting their information from a variety of different sources. Where national news networks used to be able to get upwards of 60 or 70% of the households that were and higher than that at some points of the households that were on, they now are happy if they are able to draw 30% of the households. Where's the rest of the audience going? Not to newspapers, because newspaper readership is down, though some people obviously still read newspapers. The internet now gets 15 or 20% of the general public in terms of regularly getting news from there. You do get cable news networks getting 5 or 10% each, but as a combination in the vicinity of 15%. And then you will get people who are getting news from what we now think of as non-news kinds of sources like The Daily Show. So you have a very fragmented audience getting information from a variety of different places.
Now, one of the places – The Daily Show is known probably for being more liberal politically than conventional news. It's sort of the liberal side of the street. And it's not a lot of houses in that side of the street in general, but across the street, and there's the right-wing side of the street, especially in talk radio, but also in cable TV, and there's a lot of houses and apartment buildings and condominiums over there. I think roughly 1,500 right-wing or conservative talk radio hosts at last count. I think it's a ballpark figure around the country. Every town's got its local Limbaugh or two trying to compete with the grandmaster. This, I saw, is also a significant source of news. So people, there are a lot of people who listen to these shows and see this as their primary news source. Is that correct?
I think it is in complicated in ways that are even more complicated than that, because I think that if you look at, for example, the viewership of Fox News Network, which is everyone's kind of poster child for this, it's true that their ratings are much higher than the other cable networks, but the most they ever attract is under 2 million people. I mean, their ratings are pretty small, but I think they have almost – their style of providing information has almost become like a computer virus that's been injected into the system and absorbed by lots of other news outlets.
What is that style, if I can interrupt, because I think that
part of this I learned from, you know, the kind of documentary that you've spoke on, Outfoxed, but also our analysis of coverage of the kind of case studies we do, that it's the idea that you claim you take on the mantle of professional journalism. You say that you are fair and balanced, and you start from the conservative premise that the broadcast networks that are the places where we typically think of going to get fair and balanced coverage, that they're too liberal, they're biased. So we're going to move the center to the right. We are fair and balanced. And then we just use that as a mantra to hide what is basically arguing that's stacked towards the right. And what falls by the wayside is the more traditional role of what professional journalists think of themselves as doing, which is providing a kind of baseline of factual information or even contested factual information that then you can take and then enter into ideological debates. But the danger, we think, is that when people go to Fox or go to Rush Limbaugh and go there and that's all they watch and all they listen to, then you have a very dangerous situation, especially when the competitors to Fox, like CNN and MSNBC, rather than adopting their model and becoming more liberal to balance Fox out, and this is my computer virus model, they themselves become more conservative. They try and out Fox, and that's an impossible thing to do.
Yeah, so let me get this straight. So these companies, these conservative talk show hosts and Fox News Channel, for example, they do less of what we traditionally regard as journalism, which is going out and investigating stories, coming up with what's important, covering them, analyzing them, getting it some sense of the truth of the matter, and more sort of pontificating on a handful of issues they pick. Then people coming to these channels as to get their primary source of news, then basically get an indoctrination in the issues they pick to talk about, but nothing else. But they think that's really a picture of the world that's accurate.
Exactly. And they do that consciously, so that the trademark fair and balanced is important, because they are claiming the mantle of traditional journalism when they don't behave that way. But they leave that impression. The style of reporting still makes some distinctions between a show like The O'Reilly Factor, where he can claim he's a commentator and not a traditional journalist, but then they will cut to what looks like the news, whether it's Brit Hume or whether it's the two or three minutes at the top of the hour that then leaves the audience with the impression, now I'm getting straight news. But if you look at the content of that, it is ideologically biased as well. And so it takes the trappings of traditional journalism and leads the viewer at some level to think that what they're getting is the truth, when in fact they're getting a clearly ideologically biased model.
Mm-hmm. We also try and make another point in the book, which has to do with what we want citizens to be doing in a democracy. I think if you go back to the kind of 1970s, between 1950s and the early 1980s, what we call the ripping off John Katz's phrase, we call it the golden age of broadcast news, where you had...
I call it the golden age of professional journalism, so great minds think alike here,
okay, exactly. But I
think my lawyers will be contacting you about using this term in your book, by the way.
Well, we're going to get it out very quickly before you can sue us. But I think that in that model where you had large proportions of the American public either watching one of these very similar news broadcasts and or reading a newspaper, the job of sort of the good citizen in that model was to spend at least 30 minutes a day watching this news broadcast that would give you kind of a picture of the day, and that's what it meant to be a good and well-informed citizen.
Mm-hmm.
We think that one of the real changes in this new, what we call this new media environment, is that if you do that now, you are not serving democratic purposes very well or being a good citizen, because if you spend 30 minutes a day with Fox, you're not getting the same sort of thing that you used to get when you spent 30 minutes with the CBS or NBC or ABC News. We think that citizens need to adopt more of sort of a grazing model. They need to spend time with lots of different sources. One of the advantages of the media environment that we have today is that you can get information from lots of different places. I would argue, that I would rather have my students watch The Daily Show and watch Fox and read The New York Times than just read The New York Times or just watch The Daily Show or just watch Fox. I think that the structure of the information we get requires us to move around and compare what we're getting.
You're listening to Media Matters Today on WILL AM 580. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. Our guest in the studio today, Michael Delli Carpini, the Dean of the Annenberg School for Communication at the University of Pennsylvania, and Bruce Williams, Director of the Institute of Communications Research here at the University of Illinois, Urbana-Champaign. Together, they're the authors of a new book, not yet out, but we're talking about it nonetheless, And the Walls Came Tumbling Down, a chronicle, a critique, and a discussion of the trends in journalism and news in our society and the implications for democracy. On one hand, Michael, you're talking about this rapid spread of all these new voices that weren't there before, not the bad old days of only three networks and one daily newspaper, and really what now looks like this almost Pravda-like limited number of voices, and therefore a numerical diversity. On the other hand, when I hear you talk about how MSNBC and CNBC are imitating Fox, and I hear you talk about all these sort of the monotony almost, or the monotone of the journalism, anything but diversity. And you referred to the internet earlier, but the recent statistics came out that the 20 top news and public affairs sites, and you're both nodding your heads, so you know where I'm going with this, are all but one, I think, are connected with one of the five or six huge media conglomerates and almost the major broadcast news media. I mean, how do you – what comes – you throw all this in the air. Where does it come down?
Well, it's not easy to say, obviously. And as you pointed out earlier, this is a changing environment even as we talk about it and write about it. But one way to look at this is that the new information environment has some potential for providing the kind of multiple voice, multiple sources, multiple viewpoints that you would ideally hope for in a democracy. And there are examples of where it works that way. I think if you look at recent news coverage, really since 9/11 coverage of the first the war on terrorism and then the war against Iraq, you can make a strong argument that one of the major sources of countervailing information that allowed at least people who were predisposed this way to get information that would lead them to draw conclusions that are different than that of the administration and of the mainstream media.
In a way that wouldn't have been possible.
In a way that totally wouldn't have been possible
during Vietnam or Korea or something.
That's exactly right. So there is that potential. And a lot of that potential has come from shows like yours, independent internet websites, low-power FM radio stations, and the occasional piece of information that has flowed from those sources into the mainstream media. So the potential is there, and there's actually examples of that working positively. The downside of this is that at moments, that can be stopped. And when you do get an MSNBC, a CNBC, an NBC, all owned by the same organization, add to that the pressure that the high ratings, relatively high ratings of Fox has produced for forcing these other cable stations to follow that model, and then add to that the fact that no large media organization is going to want to challenge an administration that has some control over what is or is not regulated within it, and it can create a worst-case scenario in which there is the illusion of lots of sources, but in reality, it's 57 channels but nothing on. You're getting the same voice speaking to you each time.
And how many of those channels are actually doing journalism, as we've mentioned, not actually going out and investigating claims, studying them, digging stuff up?
Well, I think that that is the real tragedy of the way the media environment is playing out. I think that there is less and less of a role or a place in American public life for a sort of dispassionate attempt to be nonpartisan in the best sense of the word. And I think that we all, you know, all of us who have spent long times, you know, criticizing media coverage of various things in the United States understand the limits of those approaches. But we're seeing what happens when that approach becomes a disappearing fragment.
Hollowed out.
Yes.
Oh, really.
And that's part of, I think, the danger of the sort of the Fox model. But I just want to say, to add something that Michael was saying, is that I think that there also is there are other sources of information that speak directly to these issues that have always been there, but they now, I think, are more important. Like, you know, think about a Michael Moore, who, think about the movie The Manchurian Candidate. These are highly political and very different pieces of media communication, but they have become very, very important parts of this debate. And I think that's important, that there are these other sources and ways of getting political information, even if the long-term trend is to make that diversity less and less possible.
You know, you guys talk about the Daily Show with Jon Stewart, and I know in our previous talk, and I don't know if this is in the book, the new version, the final version of the book, we talked about the monologues of David Letterman and Jay Leno, which I think surveys show again play, you know, for a lot of Americans. I don't know what the percentage is, but a significant percentage of Americans, double digits. This is a major entree to the world and their understanding of national politics. And you know, I watch those shows periodically, and sometimes more than periodically. And what's striking to me when I watch the monologues is that they're all based on personality. And there's almost very little issue substance. And I don't mean issues in, like, talking about some white paper on tax cuts or tariffs. But just the substance of politics. It's always about issue personality. Bill Clinton eats too much and likes to get laid. George W. Bush is a dummy who can't talk. John Kerry is a rich doofus who likes to windsurf. But it's sort of like – to me, it's just a striking absence of political content.
Well, I would say that is definitely true of Leno and Letterman, who I think come at this – without a political agenda, and whose impact is largely to create a cynical public about personalities and not about issues. I think that the Daily Show and Jon Stewart would probably fall into a different category, and that while I think in order to appreciate his show, you still have to get information from other sources, I think a lot of his critique is is about substance and about issues. Now, it still comes down to a critique about what's wrong, and that's why it's not enough in and of itself. But I would argue that The Daily Show plays a somewhat different role, and one that allows people to step back from the rhetoric they're hearing elsewhere and at least question it, if not necessarily learn something new.
And I think that The Daily Show on a day-to-day basis is much more engaged in what I would call the kind of the healthy give and take of the political realm. I mean, they and it's acknowledged by journalists themselves that Jon Stewart is one of the most significant and important media figures in the election cycle.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the reason for that is that the format of his show and how he sees it allows him a sort of freedom to explore issues that are closed off by the way journalists now define their jobs.
Yeah.
So it's only on The Daily Show that you're going to get someone like John Edwards allowed to speak for a few minutes without being interrupted. You're only going to hear, you know, what Richard Clark is really like, or allow, or make a joking and lampooning a reference to the awful Swift boat ads. And I think that part of what we try and argue is that when we talk about political information, there's nothing wrong with it being entertaining. I mean,
mm-hmm.
We're all college professors. We lecture. You know that humor in the classroom is an important part of really an effective class.
Sure. Politicians try to be entertaining.
That's right.
I know they won't have an audience without it. We're talking today with Michael Della Carpini and Bruce Williams here on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. Michael and Bruce are the co-authors of a new book coming out soon, And the Walls Came Tumbling Down, The Eroding Boundaries Between News and Entertainment and What They Mean for Mediated Politics in the 21st Century. This is a pre-recorded show. We did it a couple weeks before going on air, so please don't try to call in today. Just sit back, listen, let us do the talking. When I had you guys both on a little over 2 years ago when you were first working on the book, at that time, it was Jon Stewart and some websites and Michael Moore. That was more or less it. The game has changed quite a bit then, especially on the liberal side of the street. And I think there's been a lot of people who are to the left of the main center of the Democratic Party, to the liberal half of the spectrum and further out left, who've been unhappy with the sort of alignment politically of radio and television in this country, both mainstream and certainly with the rise of right-wing media. And so we've got new things like Air America Radio. We've got Amy Goodman's Democracy Now!, which is absolutely booming. Its audience, I think, has increased tenfold in the last year on television and radio. Where does this fit into the picture?
Well, I'd add to that, you have much more effective use of a publishing by the left of center groups.
Mm-hmm.
You have shows that are kind of hybrid shows like Keith Olbermann's show on MSNBC, which has a satirical yet, I think, left of center kind of point of view in the way that it's presented. You have other documentaries or semi-documentaries like Control Room.
Semi-documentaries that a critique of it.
info documentaries.
Okay.
So there is a lot going on the left, and I think the way it fits into the work we're doing is that this new environment, where the traditional journalism has begun to decay, has created not just more room for entertainment media to be important, but more ways for a variety of genres and new hybrid type genres to be to play an important role in the way in which citizens become informed and come to think about issues. So I think that what we're really seeing, going back to one of your earlier questions, is an environment where you can sample where you get your information from a wide variety of sources. And those sources range from sources that are ideologically committed to sources that try to be neutral to sources that are more economically and entertainment driven than they are politically driven. And I think that puts a huge amount of pressure on citizens to figure out what the source of information is that they're getting, and also a tremendous amount of pressure on traditional news outlets to compete in that environment.
I want to add something that I think has changed in the tenor of our argument over the time we've been working on this book, and that has to do with what the post 9/11 environment has meant here.
Mm-hmm.
And Michael kind of laid out, I think, the something we try and do in the book, which is point to the democratic potential in a lot of the changes in the media environment, what the kinds of things we would want to think about and emphasize if we wanted this new environment to serve democratic purposes. Mm-hmm. But in the post 9/11 world, I think there's a very, very much a darker vision of what this new media environment's going to mean, because I think that it's clear after 9/11 that the use of the war on terrorism, which clearly is the kind of war that can have no end, that inspires a kind of nameless fear and terror, that has been used by the Bush administration and elites to galvanize support for themselves. It's typical wartime propaganda that goes back for as long as there's been a mass media.
Yeah, in fact, just to interrupt, you wrote an article on that I recently read, and really showing how Harold Laswell, one of the originators of propaganda analysis, a lot of what we've seen in the last 3 years is almost directly out of his playbook.
Yeah, down to talking about demonizing an enemy like Saddam Hussein was demonized, like making any offensive attack seem defensive, and hence the connection to Al-Qaeda when we invade Iraq, and on these techniques are old, but there are two things that are very different now. First, Laswell thought that kind of propaganda was necessary when you were fighting a total war. Remember, World War I was the war to end all wars. In World War II, when that kind of propaganda techniques were used again, we were fighting fascism. And the logic behind those propaganda efforts is you have to mobilize the whole population to support nationalistic ends, because you need the economy, you need all of the society pulling in the same direction.
You can't win without it.
Right.
Or you're weaker.
I think that now these same techniques are used in a war that, whatever else the invasion of Iraq is it is not a total war for the United States. We don't have a draft army. We're not mobilizing the economy. And these techniques are still used. They're very powerful because they work, because they appeal to very deep emotions in people. And I think that they are also used because they're effective. They do get people to rally around the flag and support whatever the administration is going to do. But I think that in this new media environment and it's not just entertainment versus news, it's the fact that we get information from all over the world. It is easy to see what newspapers and media are saying about these events in other parts of the world. It gets back into the United States. And so rather than unifying a population for very long, I think that now these techniques used in this environment really wind up polarizing the population in ways that did not happen as fast as happened in past wars. Michael has done some work on the pattern of support and erosion for support in wars. But if you think about the parallel to the Vietnam War, that took a very long time before you had the kind of – it became a divisive issue.
We had major anti-war demonstrations before the war. This time, right?
That's right. Yes, exactly.
Would have been
exactly.
Unthinkable in the
That's
case
right.
of Vietnam.
That's exactly right.
And so where you have, one part of the population avidly supporting and eating up this kind of propaganda message from the state and lots of the mainstream media, and then another part of the population that doesn't believe any of it, you have a recipe for a very polarized society.
And you think that's where we're at right now, basically, or – more of the same on the way? Is it going to? I mean, is this a beginning of something, or are we right already at the apex?
Well, I think my own view, although this is subject to change because we're in uncharted territory, is that this is the beginning of something. That in fact, it is hard to imagine a scenario in which this current election does not wind up being extremely close and extremely polarizing. This election has fewer undecided voters than any election in recent memory, since polls have been done. And there are strong feelings, not necessarily in support of each individual candidate, but in support of the side that they are taking. I do not see a scenario in which that changes dramatically. And I think whoever winds up winning, you're going to have half the population or so feeling that they have lost, and not just lost an election where they can then bury the hatchet, but lost an election where the other side has been so villainized for reasons that are understandable at some level, that it's hard to imagine that whoever's in power is not going to be basically governing with support of half or less of the population.
Now, we're right now in the middle of the presidential race in 2004, and I think you've accurately, perfectly captured sort of the intensity of the various sides for Bush, for Kerry, and really against Bush and against Kerry as much as anything, or against Bush and for Bush. The news coverage in this race, you know, one of the premises of a free press and a democracy is that at the very least it equips citizens so they can make an informed choice and hold leaders accountable. And elections are sort of where the rubber hits the road in our constitutional system. Bruce, I mean, as you look at the press coverage of the last 6 months, say, and going into November, how good a job overall has our media system, our news media system, information system done of giving people the ability to participate effectively, in your view?
I think it's been pretty dismal. I think that the one of the things that we talk about in the book, and we really trace the beginnings of this to we have a chapter on the Clinton-Lewinsky scandal. And I think that with the sort of the swift boat ads and the way they get then taken up by Fox News, and then that begins to shape the agenda of other news organizations, I think that what's happened is you have this sort of the hijacking of the period of time in which we ought to be focused as a society on the issues in this election, not kind of crazed claims that are palpably false about what someone did or didn't do in Vietnam 30 years ago. I think that I think that Vietnam and the lessons we learned from it are an extraordinarily important issue right now, because I think there are a huge, very strong parallels between our engagement in Vietnam and what's happening in Iraq. And I think a debate about that would be extraordinarily important. But that's not what we're having. And I think that it's not just the media system. It is that even when there has been legislation passed to try and avoid that, because the McCain-Feingold campaign finance law was supposed to prevent this sort of thing happening in the last 60 days.
Yeah, and I think it's important to preface what you're about to say for listeners, because we had this discussion before on the show, so we might be assuming something. The close link here between the campaign finance system and media coverage, how these things are really first cousins, if not brother and sister, in making any sort of analysis of what's going on.
Yeah, to explain what I was referring to is in the campaign finance law, there is supposed to be a period starting 60 days before the election, which would have been September 3rd, when issue advocacy groups like the Swift Boat Veterans or Move On, for that matter, are no longer allowed to run ads that mention a candidate's name. And the reasoning behind that is that in the last 60 days before the election, you want to let the parties and the candidates themselves shape the agenda so that they can be talking about
directly.
But
I think the point, not to interrupt you again, Bruce, but the crucial thing about the Swift Boat and where it ties in is that what you had was extraordinarily wealthy donors were able to make a news story a news story. I mean, if they hadn't spent X million dollars buying ads, no one would even have heard of a Swift Boat country. Yeah. It wasn't like journalists went out and said, hey, we just broke open the Swift Boat story. Right.
Well,
nothing to do with journalism.
And if they didn't have Fox, I think it wouldn't have become the same kind of issue, because it's clear that the New York Times and the Washington Post really didn't know what to do with this issue. They just wanted to ignore it. They were hoping it would go away. But
even Bill Maher had John O'Neill, the author of the Unfit for Command book, on and gave him 10 or 15, a healthy stretch. I mean, so he, in Bill Maher, I think his program on HBO would be considered similar to the Stewart thing, where liberals go to like basically beat up on George W. Bush.
That's right. And so what you have happening is that the privately financed ads, at least loosely linked to the parties, incidentally, shaping the agenda through these commercials, forcing the discussion of both parties, but especially in this case the Kerry campaign, to change their ability to talk about substantive issues and have to defend themselves on this single issue, driven then, this is a great example of where both traditional journalism and the new style journalism has failed, though, because for shows like the Fox that are on the Fox News Network or cable television, this is high drama that really fits into their style of conflictual mm-hmm. politics.
And it's cheap and entertaining.
And that shows that it draws larger yeah. audiences. For the traditional news, they say, well, what do we do now? And what they do is they say, well, here's what the Swift vote folks say, and here is what the anti-Swift boat folks or the Kerry campaign says, and we've told you accurately what each has said, so you then decide what yeah. the truth is in that. And yeah. so neither really is able to step out of the cycle of this dominating political rhetoric in what is, in my mind, the most important election that we've faced at the presidential level since at least I've been voting, and I'm 51 years old.
Oh, so am I. Well, happy birthday. Bruce, you're the old-timer here.
What, yeah, I'm 52.
52. We've got a lot of years in this room, a lot of elections we've gone through. But, you know, we talk about how either party can do this, the Republicans or Democrats. Right. Rich people can influence either party. But for the life of me, Bruce, I look at those Swift vote ads, and I couldn't imagine rich Democrats, George Soros, say, plunking down that sort of money to go after Bush's record and have to get the same play in the media. I mean, it just seems like it always works one way. I mean, in terms of that sort of taking over the news cycle and buying it, especially in something, as you pointed out, that is based on what are now everyone acknowledges lies.
Well, I think that then you get to very serious, and this brings us back to the campaign finance laws, I think, is you get very you have to raise very serious questions about the role of money in American politics. One of the reasons, as you well know, Bob, I mean, you're one of the most well-known spokespersons for this.
Keep talking about that for a while.
is that the broadcast media itself are complicit in this. What were the figures? They raise now, it's four times as much money from campaign advertising now as they did in 1982.
Well, I'll give you the exact figures. They now get 12% of their revenues for the average commercial TV station comes from political ads. It was only 3% 12 years ago.
And they
four
charge,
times increase.
Despite it being against the law, they also charge 53% higher ad rates campaign commercials during this period. And so the question is, who has money and what sort of interests are they trying to further? Even having said that, though, I think that there is I would argue that there is a difference, a very big difference between the kind of ads that Move On ran, financed by George Soros money, I think that those ads took on, as hard-hitting as they might have been, they took on real policy issues of the Bush administration.
Mm-hmm.
They took on issues of, you know, standards around mercury in water and things like that. And I think that the Swift boat ads are, in my mind, worse than the Willie Horton ads, because as bad and as racist as the Willie Horton ads were in sliming Michael Dukakis, they at least tried to address something that Michael Dukakis had done while he was governor of Massachusetts. Now, I'm not defending those ads,
sure,
but I think that
there was
a link
to an empirical reality that actually once took place.
Yes, and I think that the Swift boat ads have nothing behind them but sliming John Kerry, so that, one, it forces him to adopt that agenda, and second, so it takes the heat off the fact that George Bush, you know, wore a flight suit and announced mission accomplished, but had bugged out during the Vietnam War.
Yeah, I mean, Michael, this Swift boat thing, I can tell both of you, because it's been happening quite a bit, and it's so pertinent to this election at this point, and it so exemplifies the problems that we all face. I mean, I just can't help but think, you know, if George W. Bush had John Kerry's military record, exact same record, and, you know, some like hippies came out of the woodwork and said, you know, well, actually, this guy really didn't get roughed up that bad on the Swift boat. And John Kerry had George W. Bush's record where he's off, disappeared. I mean, is it at all possible in our political culture that we'd have the Swift boat story about George W. Bush?
I don't think it would have any of the legs that you see right now. And this is where money plays an important role in this, the ability to actually create these ads. But it's not just money. It's the combination of money and ideology. And having in place a conservative talk show network in the broad sense of the word, and television
chamber
networks like Fox News, creates an environment in which most people did not see the Swiftboat ads by seeing them broadcast on television,
because
they were
seen
largely
them.
Broadcast in the in a few states. Most people have seen the ads or have not seen them but heard the controversy by their being reported and repeated and aired on shows like the Fox News Network, and then having them filter into the larger, more mainstream media.
Well, this is actually, you get to an interesting point, too, which is you're from Pennsylvania.
That's correct.
Bruce and I live in Illinois. This is a state that has been conceded to John Kerry. You're in a state that it's probably being absolutely marinated in political advertising, since
absolutely.
The core swing state. Whoever wins Pennsylvania probably wins the election.
Quite possibly, yes.
And so you're probably, the Swiftboat ads were running on 24/7 heavy cycle probably
right.
on Philadelphia TV. We never got them here, I don't
saw
think.
Them regularly, yes.
Unless you watched, as I force myself to do, Fox News, because
they show them for free, gratis.
Well, in fact, on my way over, when I was getting ready, I turned on Fox, and that's where I saw actually my first real Swiftboat ad, because there's a new one out today. And again, let me point out that the intent of the Campaign Finance Act was that this should not be allowed to happen now.
Mm-hmm.
There shouldn't be these groups from outside the parties allowed to basically hijack the campaign.
We should add that there's some blame to also be – this is a case where there are no good guys, but there's some blame also to be put on, I think, the Kerry campaign for not figuring out an effective way to kind of respond to this. Now, it certainly is not easy, but I don't see a lot of evidence that they've figured out a good way to sort of take the agenda back.
Yeah, go ahead, Bruce.
And let me just add to – because I brought up the unfortunate case of Michael Dukakis. As a political scientist who has some passing familiarity with the data on voting behavior, I think that while I was frustrated with Michael Dukakis's campaign, I think that there's no way that Michael Dukakis could have won that election. I think that the deck was stacked. You're talking about running against an incumbent administration, high popularity, good economy. Under those circumstances, almost no challenger ever wins.
Sort of like 2000.
Yes. right. And my point exactly. Yeah. You know, Gore won. But I think that now this is a campaign that the fact that Kerry is making some of the same mistakes and the Democrats haven't figured out a way to deal with this, this is an election that I think 2 months ago, serious pollsters were saying this is Kerry's to lose.
Mm-hmm.
And it looks like he is trying to lose it. And I think that that's very disturbing.
We're talking today on Media Matters with Bruce Williams. You just heard the director of the Institute of Communications Research here at the University of Illinois, and Michael Delacarpini, the dean of the Annenberg School for Communication at the University of Pennsylvania. They're the co-authors of a book that's not yet out, but soon to be out, and I think you're all going to want to see it. And the Walls Came Tumbling Down, the Eroding Boundaries Between News and Entertainment. And I think if you're interested in politics and you're interested in media, and you probably are if you're listening to this show, this is a book you're definitely going to want to read when it comes out. And we're going to get you back in the show, by the way, when it does come out and talk about it some more. We've only got a few minutes left, and I'd like to turn this discussion, if I can, to our day jobs, which is we are all – you're both administrators now. I'm a professor in communication and media studies. With the sort of problems that you're outlining in this book, and I've written about similar problems in my own books, what does that mean for us as those who are teaching undergraduates and teaching PhD students to go into journalism, to go in communications? I mean, how does that factor into your thinking? Because you're a dean, Bruce, you're a director in your day-to-day operations.
Well, I think at a minimal level, our students are citizens, and I see it as one of my major responsibilities, both in my administrative position, but also as a teacher and a researcher, to make sure that at least our students understand the way in which the media works well enough that they can insulate themselves from the negative aspects of it and take advantage of the positive aspects. Beyond that, I think we have a responsibility as members of a university to see part of our role of educating, especially graduate students, so that the work that they do, the research they do, and the teaching they do adheres strongly to the basic notions of what is high-quality research and teaching, but does it in a way that is relevant to the real world of public policy and the real world of journalism and the media, so that they can do work that, in fact, is likely to have an impact on public discourse about these issues and an impact on the way in which we structure the media in the United States.
Do you teach journalism at the University?
We don't teach directly. We don't train journalists. Mm-hmm. We have faculty members who do work that is a critique of journalism, but we are not a journalism school.
Yeah, I want both of you to answer this, even though I know, Bruce, you don't have a journalism school under your purview, but we have a journalism department next to us in the College of Communication. You know, one of the real issues for training, educating journalists has been, you know, the sort of environment you're describing, where you've hollowed out a lot of the research. There's a lot of stenography where a lot of it is just sort of show business. You know, what is the job of it? I mean, our journalism programs in universities training people to do what was done theoretically, at least, and sometimes practically 20, 30, 40 years ago, and what by democratic theory might be necessary, who are then being trained for jobs that don't exist. And maybe overqualified for what they're going to get paid, or do they go to the new world order? I mean, and then they don't really. Is there a reason for journalism education then? I mean, Bruce?
Well, I think that journalism is in a crisis for the reasons that you described. I think that a lot of journalists are finding themselves in situations where their training is either telling them to not do things they're being forced to do if they want to keep getting a paycheck, or is just really silent on what they should, what standards, what ideals, how they can negotiate this new environment that they're in. I think that it's part of the job of people like us to be engaged in a conversation with people, with journalists and people who train journalists. That's not always easy. No profession likes to be criticized by outsiders. But I think that it's terribly important that anybody who has what we call in our book the media soapbox, that anyone, whether it's Michael Moore or a reporter for the New York Times or someone or Bruce Springsteen, I think that when they are standing on that media soapbox, I think that there are certain sorts of responsibilities and obligations that they need to think about.
Yeah, we've got a second left, and I really want to ask Michael something, because you know you're the dean of the Annenberg School. The money for it came from Walter Annenberg, owner of many media properties in his long career, including TV Guide and the Racing Forum. And, you know, people always ask me this question. I mean, so many media programs that offer PhDs and teach undergraduates are funded by commercial media interests, whether either directly or through the fortunes that were generated by media. Does that put strings? Does that limit the ability of scholars to be critical of the status quo?
It doesn't in the case of the Annenberg School and the Annenberg money that we received, in large part because the money was given to the school in order for the school to play a role in research and education that included critical studies. And so we have a number of critical scholars mm-hmm. on our faculty. I can't speak and would be very nervous about monies that come from media outlets or individuals that are still very active in the media
yeah.
world.
Yeah.
And I think it's a mixed bag. I think it needs to be taken seriously.
Gentlemen, I hate to say it, but this time has shot by much faster than I thought it would, and I regret it because I could talk to you for a couple more hours. Michael Della Carpini, thank you so much for joining us today in Media
My pleasure.
Matters.
It's been fun.
Bruce Williams, as always, it's a pleasure. I'll see you probably very soon
right.
at work.
Right.
I'm Bob McChesney. You've been listening to Media Matters here on WILL AM 580. I want to thank Victor Picard, the wonderful producer for the show, and I'll be back in 167 hours. Bye-bye.
What's on your mind? Share your thoughts on our new program, The Public Square, beginning Friday, October 1st. Each week, we'll air the comments of a member of our community at 4:45 and 6:45 on Fridays, and again Saturday mornings just before 11. Call us at 244-5074 or log on to WILL.UIUC.edu to find out more about The Public Square, coming to your public radio station, WILL, Urbana.
This afternoon in Champaign-Urbana, mostly sunny with a high in the mid-70s and northeast winds 5 to 10 miles per hour. Tonight, mostly clear with a low in the upper 40s and northeast winds around 5 miles per hour. Tomorrow, mostly sunny with the high in the upper 70s and north winds around 10 miles per hour. This is WILL Urbana, listener-supported public radio. It's 2 p.m. Central Time. A Prairie Home Companion is next.